This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1502, recorded Thursday, April 28th, 2016.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now to take advantage of their Mother's Day limited time sale through May 3rd only. And enter promo code TNT for a free color upgrade.
And by Igloo Software. Igloo is an intranet you'll actually like. It connects people with the information they need to do their best work. Try it for free at igloosoftware.com/twit or sign up for a live demo to see it in action.
Oh, hi there. This is Tech News Today. This is a show where we talk about the tech news. I'm Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. You just surprised Megan is all. You stumbled in. We didn't know you were going to walk through that door, and there you were.
Yeah.
So we're just a little surprised. But, hey, it's good to have you here. Let's talk about some technology stuff.
Let's do, yes. All right. Sources at Recode say that Google has hired Rick Osterloh, former president of Motorola, to head the new unified hardware team. Joining us to talk about why this is so important is Mark Bergen, reporter at Recode. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what can you tell us about Osterloh's new hardware division?
Sure. I think you can think of it as Google is and has been historically like a series of fiefdoms. And this is an attempt to tie the various fiefdoms that put together hardware products together under one roof and one leader for the first time ever.
So they've never had a hardware?
First attempt.
They've never had a hardware division before?
They've had loose groupings that you could roughly call hardware. I think there were some attempts around Android. There were attempts around Chrome. And then there was with Glass. From my understanding, the Glass team was also trying to unite a lot of the hardware stuff under Glass and then the vision of wearable products. And we all kind of know what happened there.
It wasn't good.
I think this is like the first time he's taking on all those products as well as Chromecast and OnHub, which is our wireless router. And those were even, OnHub was actually built out of a separate division that was a separate Alphabet company, and that's moved back into Google, which is all terribly confusing. But there were a bunch of teams working on various projects and the different directions, which is something that Google historically has done, is almost a strategic thing, right? You kind of pair groups against each other, and then they'll innovate. But now I think they're trying to have a much more uniform experience.
Do you think that any of this is kind of, at least to some degree, a reaction from kind of their experience with, well, just taking Nest, for example? Nest has had a decent amount of kind of rocky news over the past couple of months as far as, they had great ambitions for what the division was going to do. Doesn't necessarily seem like it's delivering. Internally, Google is kind of, having issues with Nest and kind of the perception of Nest and everything like that. Is this kind of an indication that Google is losing faith possibly in that division and needs to kind of put it in the hands of somebody else to kind of bring it up to its potential?
Yeah, I think when Nest was initially acquired, there was a sense that Tony Fadell, the CEO, would kind of take over a bunch of hardware projects inside Google proper. And that's clearly not been the case. Nest is moved in a different direction for a variety of reasons around software. I think they're kind of positioning themselves as like, we're the thoughtful home company. Mm-hmm. And they've always been trying to keep arm's length from Google for reasons, that Google wants, but also Nest wants. And certainly with the Alphabet, they are operating as two different companies. It will be interesting to see, there's an expectation that Google has this real strong need to compete with Amazon and Alexa, and the Echo device, which sort of came out of nowhere and is basically on Google's home turf, right? Alexa Echo is a search device. Mm-hmm. And so it's something that maybe this will come out of Rick's new group. It certainly hasn't come out of Nest yet.
So you haven't heard about a product that's in the works? You don't have any details about a product's in the works? Secret details you could tell us about?
A secret details?
Like an Echo-like product from Google?
I do think that we reported this before. I think the Nest team and Tony Fadell had attempted to put out something competing with Echo. And some of the reservations they had were that consumers might not want Google listening in on their home. Mm-hmm. Google kind of, I think, does more, they're more siloed, especially on data, than we think. It's interesting, maybe consumers are more willing to have Amazon listening on your home than Google.
Or maybe with the success of Amazon and Echo, if that continues along, then that's kind of rewriting the expectation of what consumers want. Mm-hmm. And actually, consumers are okay with it because they're buying these devices in droves. Now, Motorola hardware was never better, in my opinion anyways, than it was when Google owned it and when Rick was kind of heading up the effort there. Do you think this would kind of be a return to that type of glory, that kind of perception from a public sense with Rick kind of handling all of the hardware that Google has?
Maybe. I don't necessarily get any indication that they're trying to build up a massive hardware business, right? I think it's still sort of directional, right? The hardware is the means to the end, which is for Google services, content, in machine learning, the software, search. I could be wrong on that, but that's kind of the hunch. You know, that there is some rumors up there and some reports that with Nexus, they have bigger ambitions. And I think maybe there's people on the Nexus team that want tighter control around the phones. Certainly, there's a lot of Android that is frustrated with like crappy Android experiences.
Sure.
And so they've always used Nexus as sort of like a tentpole. This is what we wish Android would look like. This could be an indication that they maybe have more directives, right? Like the next Nexus devices will have even more hardware specifications that they want everyone else that builds Android to follow.
Mm-hmm. Do you know who he's reporting to?
Reporting to Sundar. Yeah.
Right to the man.
Right to the man himself. Yeah, he's an SVP. They didn't give him a CEO title, although there are plenty of CEOs in the alphabet. So I think sure. I just counted recently, and there's 9.
So. That's a lot.
So you're saying there's a chance.
There's a chance. He could be CEO.
What also kind of stood out to me is that, you know, it was kind of a big loss to ATAP, losing Regina Duggan, I think like a week or two ago. And it seems like Rick Osterloh is kind of filling those shoes as well. Is that right?
Yeah, I think my understanding was that ATAP and Regina was more of an R&D organization. I don't think Rick's considered more of he's a product engineer, or he's a project engineering lead. He ships product and he ships hardware. So this could be interpreted as maybe Google is steering away, Google proper, from R&D, or moving R&D into a different part of the company. Certainly, like the R&D, I guess, is now a lot of that is with artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. And DeepMind is their kind of AI R&D that's just working on solving research and solving intelligence there. So I don't know as much about the ATAP as I should. I think parts of that have moved into the VR division in Google. There's still a big question mark about if there are future virtual reality devices that come out of Google. Is that going to come out of Rick's organization, or is that going to come out of the VR team? I don't know.
Yeah, it kind of makes me wonder as far as ATAP. You know, ATAP has a lot of projects that you hear about, but you don't necessarily see the results of. Tango is probably the most visible one, and based on the Google I/O calendar, we're going to hear a lot about Tango. So maybe what this says is some of those projects inside ATAP that were a little bit more experimental might actually finally see the light of day. Maybe we'll see Project Ara. Maybe we'll see Tango in more of a productized release sort of way, and Rick could head that. That would be really exciting, I think.
Right. I think Tango was their proxy partnership with Lenovo, which would make sense. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen anything about the wearable pants that they announced last year.
Yep. Was that solely? That was Jacquard. That's right.
Yeah.
Project Jacquard.
That's nice. Yeah.
You never know. Soon our pants could be technology. You never know.
Well, yeah.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us. Mark is a reporter at Recode, M.H. Bergen on Twitter, and you wrote an excellent piece, a follow-up piece on the Wade's stalking piece that Kashmir Hill posted in Fusion.
Oh, yeah. So
it was a great piece. If anyone's interested in that, yeah, check that out. Thanks so much, Mark.
All right. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Take care. All right, so we were talking a little bit about Amazon, and so speaking of, today was a big day for Amazon. They're flying high, thanks in no small part to their hardware division. Amazon earnings today revealed that the company's devices are exploding with successes in its Echo line, as we were just talking about, along with a doubling of sales versus this time last year in its Fire tablet line. That's its Android tablet lineup. Analysts expected Amazon to post a profit of $27.98 billion, and Amazon surpassed that with $29.1 billion, so it was a big increase. Another big component to its success has been its cloud computing division, of course, Amazon Web Services. There, Amazon saw a profit of $604 million, actually making that Amazon's most profitable chunk of business. I mean, companies like Netflix, you know, rely on Amazon's cloud services, so it's no wonder.
Yeah, there was also a lot of growth in Prime, which was interesting. So on the earnings call, they said, you know, because we talked about last week, they were changing Prime so you could do it monthly instead of just yearly. There were some interesting things about that. He said that they're adding international Prime subscribers at a high clip. Also, they've been criticized recently about customers not getting same-day delivery in low-income areas, which I thought was interesting. And when they addressed that by saying that the new monthly Prime plan they thought would bring it more low-income, would bring Amazon and Amazon Prime delivery into more low-income areas, presumably, I guess, because people could afford to just do it month by month as opposed to laying out the $100.
Right, so, or if you know this is going to be a big month of spending on one thing or another, you just sign up and then be done.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I think. The earnings, they can be boring and overwhelming, but I like picking out the little pieces. It's like, oh, that's interesting, a little hint in there.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, 1 year ago, just 1 year ago, Amazon reported a $53 million loss. And what a turnaround in just a year. This was Amazon's biggest quarterly profit in the company's history. So it's very interesting to see the delta between the big behemoth tech companies that are hurting right now and really fighting, struggling to kind of turn it around, affected by the market. And then you got companies like Amazon and Facebook, but Amazon, that's still kind of tied into the hardware thing, but making it work. And, you know, a big reason for that is because they're differentiating their hardware in different ways. The Echo is just, it's a hit. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much, how much revenue was driven specifically because of that particular category, but it's certainly been a success from the sense that it's brought a lot of eyeballs, more eyeballs to Amazon. And I don't know, has people thinking differently about that type of technology.
And it's all connected too. I mean, you have to be, you know, it's, if you have an Echo, you're probably a Prime subscriber. You can't, you know, you had to be a Prime subscriber in order to buy one at first. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's all tied in. I mean, that it's like, that's what's so interesting about them. Like, they have so many, they have products and they have software and they have Amazon Web Service and it's all tied in together.
Yep. Integration. Mm-hmm. Integration, as they say.
So this week, Apple's earnings were a big disappointment, and many are saying that we might be seeing peak iPhone. Mm-hmm. Writing in Six Colors today, Jason Snell takes a deeper dive into what these numbers mean, and he's joining us today. Welcome, Jason.
Hey there. Good to be back.
So you write that these earnings tell us absolutely nothing about the latest iPhone and iPad models. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. The quarter actually ended before the new stuff that they announced, the 9.7-inch iPad Pro and the iPhone SE, had even come out. So we have to use a line from Hamilton, I guess, we have to wait for it. There's another 3 months before we'll really get an idea. However, they did, in the conference call afterward when they talked to the financial analyst, they did give some hints. And specifically, the iPhone SE is like a sleeper hit for them. I think it caught Apple off guard, which maybe says something about how Apple prioritizes what's important with the iPhone. I think the Apple execs, like a lot of people in the tech industry, got really caught up in this bigger is better thing that nobody wants small phones, everybody wants big phones. And, you know, the iPhone 6 was a huge success. You could actually argue that it was an aberrant success, so much so that now Apple's paying, because compared to last year, this year doesn't look that great. Although I think they still had 20 times the profit of Amazon last quarter. So, you know, bad quarters are what you make of them. But they missed it. They actually are, for the first time for an iPhone model in a long time, they are out of iPhones. They can't make the iPhone SE fast enough because they completely misjudged demand for it. And Tim Cook owned up to it. He said, we didn't expect that people would get this because they just like a smaller phone. And they missed the boat on that one.
So do you think there's a lot of people upgrading from the 6 to the SE because they wanted a smaller phone?
I don't think that's the case. I'm sure some of them are doing that. I'm sure there's a class of user who bought the 6 because it was the latest and greatest and then said, I don't really love it. I really miss the old size, who over the next, maybe now or maybe over the next year or two, will consider the SE instead of a 6S or a 7 iPhone. I think there were a lot of people who stayed on the 5S because they like the 5S and didn't want to go up to that bigger phone. I've heard from a lot of those people saying, at last, you know, finally I can get a new iPhone with all the features that they've added in the last couple of years. So I definitely think that they're, you know, that's part of the market for this, is people who sat it out. And yeah, maybe a little bit people who decided they didn't like the bigger phone after all.
So there was a piece in The Verge today, I think it was, the headline was, "We have seen the end of the $700 smartphone." And Jason and I were talking about this, and we were talking about it in terms of Android phones. You know, just that there are so many $700, you know, there's so many cheaper Android phones that do the same thing as the $700 ones.
Yeah.
But in this case, I mean, do you think that's the case for Apple as well? I mean, this phone starts at $399, right? Do you think...
Apple's a premium brand, you know, and they're always going to sell stuff at the high end that people are going to buy. It's always going to be aspirational to a certain degree. But that said, you know, the iPhone SE is the first phone that Apple has sold new at $350. And that is a huge deal for them. Or, I mean, $399, sorry. Mm-hmm. But it is the lowest starting price of any new iPhone ever. It's the latest technology in there. It's not last year's tech. It's last fall's tech. But it's the top of the line tech, at least until September, when there's a new iPhone announced, right? And it is going to be part of the story, not just in some markets where Apple hasn't played very well because their entry level has been too expensive. But I think for people who are, for the first time in some places, including the U.S., seeing the real cost of their phone and saying, oh, wow, I didn't realize I was dropping $500 every 2 years on a phone because it was hidden in my bill. And maybe I don't want to do that anymore.
Well, how successful does the iPhone SE need to be, do you think?
Well, I mean, Apple said that last year with the 5S, so with an old phone, they still probably sold about, I did the math, about 13% of iPhones sold last year were the 5S, and that was an old phone. And I think that shows, and it was more expensive by $50 than the SE is. So I think there's a real opportunity here. Since that they can't meet demand, I mean, what does that mean? Is it 20%? I think a really great couple of quarters where it makes up 20% of the iPhone's product mix is reasonable. And, you know, there are five iPhone models. They're the big and small of the 6 and the 6S, and then there's the SE. So if one-fifth of your line makes one-fifth of your volume for the first couple of quarters that it's out, that's not unreasonable. And, you know, that's probably about in line with it. It doesn't need to be the 50% market eater of a phone, because that's probably the mainstream, like the 6S right now. And the Plus has less of an audience and the SE has less of an audience, but it can still be part of a bigger story. And it gives Apple more prices and more options for buyers.
Yeah, it really seems to me, and I'm not an iOS user, I don't have an iPhone and everything like that, but from the Android point of view, looking in, it seems like the difference here with the SE is that Apple has tried the lower cost device, but it was a lower, you know, it was a lesser performing device, and the design never was that kind of eye-catchy. The C never really caught my eye. Like, the colors, I'm sure that made some people happy, but it still felt and looked kind of cheap. And when I think of Apple devices, I think of premium. You get the premium out of the SE, so I understand why it's doing well. I'm very curious to know if, you know, a year down the line, if this is a new category for Apple going forward, the smaller form factor, or is it a reusing previous form factors but increasing their guts, you know, like they did in this case. So is it the size, or is it the fact that they're reusing kind of the older design to move forward that defines the category?
Given what Tim Cook said on Tuesday, I think they've realized that there is a market who prefers the smaller phone.
And so they're going to continue
and they miscalculated, and they admitted they miscalculated that. So my guess is that unless there's a real reversal here, Apple is going to target a 4-inch phone for the foreseeable future. Maybe they'll get away from the iPhone 5 design at some point down the road. I mean, if the SE stays in the product line for another couple of years as is, that gives them an opportunity, if it's a hit, to maybe redesign it along the lines of the iPhone 7 design language, whatever that might be. And I would expect them to do that. But it sounds like, you know, they have recognized that some people just don't want a big phone. And having three sizes of phones in your product line is probably not a bad idea.
Yeah.
Well, Jason, I'm sorry. I said that your article was on 6 colors. It is also on 6 colors, but also in Macworlds as well.
I got a couple. Yeah, I've got a piece. I had to write a bunch this week about Apple stuff. There's a lot of Apple news this week. And so some of it's at 6 colors and some of it's at Macworld. Yeah.
Okay. And you do so much. So is there anything else that we need to mention besides your Hamilton podcast, of course?
Yeah, well, go to theincomparable.com for all the many podcasts, including some that are about musicals and some that are more about geeky in other ways. So, yeah, check it all out.
All right. Thanks so much, Jason.
Thank you, Jason.
Take care. Thanks.
All right. Have a good night. All right. Chrome OS fans, rejoice. I'll rejoice. I'm pretty happy about this. The platform has a new high-end option. Of course, the $1,000 Chromebook Pixel has always kind of held the throne as the nicest, you know, nicer, more premium Chromebook available. But here comes the HP Chromebook 13, with a few different configuration options. One that actually goes toe-to-toe with the Pixel. Now, at the low end, it starts at $499, brings a kind of a modest Skylake 1.5 gigahertz Core M Pentium system on chip. 13.3 inch 1080p display. So not like super high res display, but good enough for starters, 4 gigs of RAM. And then at $599, you get a nice bump to 2.2 gigahertz turbo core M3 with a 3200 by 1800 display. So really nice upgraded sharp display. And then it goes all the way up to 1029. So just a slight bit more than the current Chromebook Pixel for the core M7 and a maxed out 16 gigs of RAM for your web browsing laptop. But hey, I'll take all the RAM that I can get. And, you know, eventually you run up against that. Its body's a brushed metal, kind of Pixel-like in that regard, but has some nice rounded edges versus the Pixel's kind of sharp corners that has. And then two USB-C ports, so you're not just stuck with one. It also has a USB-A port for compatibility. And I don't know, I'm just kind of happy to see Chrome OS get some more premium upgrade options. I'm a big fan of the Chromebook Pixel, and I like that they're kind of finding, you know, that there is a market, at least, for kind of the higher-end Chromebook or Pixel
but
line.
No touchscreen.
But I don't know, like when I think about the touchscreen on the Pixel, like I guess I use it sometimes, but it comes in handy. It's nice to have
it. You got to check. You touched it. You're like, can I touch this?
Because when I use it in Drive, it's a turd, because Drive is not good in the browser with touchscreen. But yeah, I guess it's nice to have it. It's not a deal breaker, but if you need to have it, obviously the Chromebook Pixel still exists. Obviously, schools are driving a lot of success in Chrome OS right now, and this, you know, kind of premium category is not meant, you know, is not going to be touching into that market. Mm-hmm. But it's nice to have the option. I don't know. Are you at all enticed by a Chromebook?
I have tested Chromebooks before, yeah. And my kids use Chromebooks at school. I mm-hmm. am enticed by it. And I bring up the touchscreen because I think that was the hybrid was the big thing last year. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got to have a hybrid. Mm-hmm. But now it's just interesting. And I wonder if we're moving back. I wonder if a lot of people don't really use that. Like they just either want a laptop or they want a touchscreen. Like
yeah.
Two together isn't something people use regularly.
Yeah. I mean, I've had it in my, you know, since I got the Pixel a couple of years ago, and I've used this Pixel quite a bit. And I don't know, like if I had to like guess, I use the touchscreen maybe 5% of the time. It's not a regular way of doing it. I'm just very used to kind of flying. But it's nice to have the option. So I just don't know if it's absolutely a necessity when you're talking about it. If it's a matter of touchscreen versus having kind of like a premium nice keyboard feel and a good touchpad and that kind of stuff, I would absolutely opt for kind of the upgraded body design itself instead of the touchscreen. So, but I think everybody's going to be a little different in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Well, after the break, we will talk about some new apps for your Windows 10 machine. We are covering all of the OSs today. I'm very proud of us. But first, let's take a minute to thank Tracker, the sponsor of this episode. With advancements in technology, we now have smart cars and smart phones and smart homes. But you still lose your stuff, and that can make you feel less than smart. Tracker makes losing things a thing of the past. Now, I have a Tracker on my keychain, and I can use my phone to find my keys. It also works the other way around. It's awesome. The coin-sized device locates misplaced keys, wallets, computers, even pets in seconds. Pair Tracker to your iOS or your Android device, attach it to anything via the key loop or adhesive, and find its precise location with the tap of a button. Lose your phone, press the button on the Tracker, and your phone will ring even if your phone is on silent. With over 1.5 million devices, Tracker has the largest crowd GPS network in the world, so your lost item shows up on a map even if it's miles away. If an item goes missing, the Tracker app records its last known location on a map. When another Tracker user comes within 100-foot range of your lost item, you will receive a GPS update of where your item is. Tracker recently introduced Tracker Atlas, which works with your Tracker Bravo or third-party Bluetooth tracker to pinpoint your items on a customizable floor plan of your home. Save time and energy by simply asking Tracker Atlas where your item is, and you'll instantly get an answer. No need to search. Go to thetracker.com and never lose your possessions again. Right now, Tracker is having a Mother's Day limited sale through May 3rd only with their best prices ever. Just for our audience, if you enter promo code TNT, you'll get a free color upgrade. That's thetracker.com, promo code TNT.
All right, so Microsoft and Facebook sitting in a tree. And joining us to finish that poem, whether he likes it or not, is Matt Weinberg from Business Insider. How's it going, Matt?
I don't like it at all.
I know. You don't have to finish it. I won't actually ask you to sing the rest of the song.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. I'm happy you didn't just disconnect when you heard that. The news here, of course, is that Facebook is finally making good on its promise to bring to Microsoft to deliver some key Windows 10 apps to its platform. Tell us a little bit about that announcement.
I mean, on the surface, it's not... On the surface, it's really not that big a deal because Microsoft wants more apps for Windows 10, right? Yeah. Facebook, it's about as big as it gets. Facebook wants more eyeballs. Microsoft's got them in droves. It's kind of natural. It's just kind of a wonder it's taken this long, right? Mm-hmm. It's Instagram, Facebook, and Facebook Messenger. I played around with them a little bit at this point. They're pretty cool. I have not played around with them on a Windows phone because I don't know anyone who has one. But on the desktop and the tablet, they're pretty neat.
So what were Windows 10 users using before access to these apps? I guess the web apps or third-party clients?
The web apps. And the real trick is, and this is always the way with apps in general, is that you can always use the website, but an app that lives on your computer that you have full access to, it's faster, it's easier, it's slicker. It puts it all in one place. Using these apps, it's actually really heartening to see that Facebook really thought about the design. It's actually faster and a little more user-friendly in these Windows apps, I personally think, than just having it open in a Chrome tab all day.
So the Instagram app. Now, Instagram is one of those apps that works wonderful on my iPhone, but not on my iPad, and it doesn't really work on the desktop. I mean, that was kind of their thing. Does it work the same on all platforms with Windows 10?
Yeah, So Instagram is the one of the three that I've had the least chance to play around with. It's pretty much the same. There's nothing that exciting. I haven't even looked now that you mention it, but if it has the upload photo button, it would also be the first time you could upload a photo to Instagram from the desktop. So that would be kind of a big deal. Mm-hmm. But that said, it really just speaks to Microsoft's overall app strategy here, which is get them to build for the desktop. And then those same apps will also work on the Windows phone. The same app, same code, same bright, beautiful group hug, no matter which Windows 10 device you're using it with.
Yeah, I mean, this really has been kind of the constant struggle that, you know, come up time and time again, which is that if you're a Windows 10 user, you have Windows, you know, 10 mobile, the app category is so limited, and what you really need are some of the big players to come in and kind of legitimize the platform a little bit more by actually paying attention to it and doing that. Do you think an action like this from a company as big as Facebook could effectively do that? Could this kind of lead to more development?
I mean, in a lot of ways, yeah, because now Windows 10 Mobile has Uber, it has Facebook, it has Hulu, I believe it has Netflix. Those are kind of the big guys, but what people forget sometimes is that the big guys started small. Mm-hmm. What Microsoft struggle here is like having Facebook and Instagram and all that is great, but it's about getting the next big thing. And you know, the real innovation of the App Store way back in 2008, 2009 was that it let anyone start off small and get bigger. Microsoft has the resources and the know-how to go to your Facebooks and your Ubers and get them to sign deals. The real question is, can they attract literally everyone else? You know? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So you said you don't use a Windows phone. Did you used to use a Windows phone?
I briefly used a Windows Phone 8.1. This must have been 2 years ago now. And I actually really liked it. And I hear that Windows 10 Mobile takes all the stuff that I liked about Windows Phone 8.1 and just kind of made it more so. I think there's a lot that Apple and Google could learn from Windows Phone. But as long as it has such a low market position, There's no pressure for them to do so, which is kind of a shame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, there's a relationship now between Microsoft and Facebook that's very different than the past. Can you talk a little bit about like what their relationship was back when Microsoft invested in them and how that evolved?
Yeah. So back when Microsoft first invested in Facebook, this was way back in 2007. You know, it was Microsoft makes a lot of investments in a lot of companies, you know, and this was back when social was still a very unproven concept. So Microsoft kind of stood there in the back, you know, smiling and nodding once in a while and announcing partnerships with Skype for video calling and Bing for web searching. Then Facebook got big and they developed their own technology. They didn't really need Microsoft anymore to provide all of that stuff under the hood. Now, that relationship, I don't know if it fell apart exactly, but they kind of went their separate ways. Nowadays, you know, Microsoft is working on the HoloLens, which is awesome, and Facebook has Oculus, and which is virtual reality, and they're two sides of the same coin, and in so many other ways, they're totally aligned. They're both talking about chatbots. They're both talking about bringing their apps everywhere, and it just seems like they've realized that they're two great tastes that go great together. And they've started working with each other, you know, with really complementary technology, which is really interesting to see.
Hmm. All right. So you also wrote today about Cloudflare, which is a pretty darn important component to the smooth operation of the internet. Cloudflare actually handles nearly 10% of all web traffic. They made a big change that could improve the web. Explain what they're rolling out.
So the thing that they're rolling out, it's a little nerdy. It's called HTTP2 server push, which is... I don't know. I didn't name it. But the idea is that, you know, evolving web standards, when the web was, you know, the web as we know it mostly today, those standards were set in 1997. Those standards kind of evolve in fits and spurts because as the web gets bigger, it's hard to get everyone to agree on anything. It's like politics. And so as we're going on, we have these amazing new technologies. We have the real limitation of HTTP, which is the current standard, is that it only loads things one at a time, which means that if you hit refresh on that page right now, it would load the text and then the photos and then the video, you know, and or vice versa or whatever. That's not really ideal for today's web when we have so much going on every web page. We have apps, we have movies, we have games, we have interactive content, the whole shebang. The web was struggling to keep up. So they came up with a new standard called HTTP2. The problem with the new standard is getting people to actually adopt it. And HTTP2 supports this feature called server push that makes it even faster than just stock standard, plain old HTTP2. So Cloudflare, which is a long buildup, but Cloudflare announced it's supporting HTTP2 server push, which means that all of its customers, all of its many, many customers, 10% of the whole internet, now have a really easy way to activate server push, which in turn means web pages that load 15-20% faster. That cuts seconds off of your load times. That means that a page that used to take 3 seconds to load now takes 2 seconds or 1 second, which doesn't sound like a big deal, but that's us on our broadband connections. Imagine out in the developing world when you have 2G speeds, when you have super slow internet, it means that pages that before wouldn't load at all, maybe now your bandwidth can handle it without choking. And then for us here, it enables all kinds of nifty new web apps that, you know, we've had the technology, but no reasonable human being would sit there waiting 20 seconds for this web app to load or for the web app to refresh or whatever. And now we have a way to speed all of that up without users actually having to do anything.
But developers had to do some things to get on board with this, right?
Yes.
What do they have to do to take part in this?
Yeah. So they have to go into the code. There's a thing called link headers in HTML code that they have to go through and enable. What Cloudflare has done, you know, they can only take developers so far. It's a horse to water kind of scenario. Mm-hmm. They can enable it. They can take care of all the hard part of thinking about like the backend technology and the stuff, the, you know, the wibbly wobbly stuff that exists out in the cloud that makes it all work. What developers still have to do is go into their code, enable the stuff that makes server push work in those link headers. It's not, you know, there's a lot of web pages out there, and web pages contain multitudes of other web pages. So it's not like simple, but this work. And hopefully what Cloudflare says is that within the next year, by virtue of them having done this heavy lifting, we'll start to see web pages speed up a little bit at a time.
I certainly hope so. I'm all down for a faster web. Matt Weinberger, thanks so much, as always, for coming on the show and telling us about a couple of the stories you wrote today. Where can people follow all of your work online?
You can find me at businessinsider.com/SAI or follow me at Gamoid on Twitter.
Fantastic.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks so much, Matt. Have a wonderful evening.
Take care.
See you later.
You too.
So we got an email from James Lomax from the UK. He sent us a BBC story about how lawyers from Facebook-owned Instagram are going after an app called Littergram that encourages people to take pictures of trash and report the location to their counsel, so in order to clean up the trash. Danny Lucas, creator of the app, has sent an impassioned video plea to Mark Zuckerberg appealing to his environmental side, asking to keep the name Littergram. Lawyers said they respected what Lucas was doing, but the name was unacceptable. Lucas should probably use the internet to come up with another name, I think, like Litter McLitterface.
It just never gets old, does it?
No, I don't think so. Obviously, I don't think it gets old. If you think it gets old, then let me know.
I don't know. I actually kind of like Litter McLitterface.
Yeah. So thanks for writing in. Yeah. You know, you can TNT at twit.tv. Or directly to me at megan@twit.tv. I won't tell you Jason's email address.
I know. You're so brave at just giving it out. But, you know, I mean, it's pretty easy to guess. If you really want to email me, I'm pretty sure you can figure it out. All right, coming up, what you going to do with that smartphone when you go to that show or performance? I'll tell you what, nothing. But first, let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode, and that's Igloo. Igloo is an intranet you're actually going to like. It's a cloud platform. It helps you share files, collaborate on documents, blog updates, coordinate calendars, manage projects, everything that you need to do. Anyone can add content based on their permissions with drag and drop widgets, as well as a WYSIWYG editor that's built in there. Igloo also offers a variety of access, authentication, and identity services to ensure that only authorized users have access in private clouds over SSL with 256-bit encryption. Now, unlike other solutions, you can customize Igloo to fit your needs and work with your current IT investments like Office 365, Salesforce, SharePoint, Active Directory, and file sharing solutions as well, things like Google Drive and Dropbox. You can even add Zendesk to keep track of or add new support tickets. It's used by large enterprises and growing companies like User Testing, BDO, American Family Insurance, and ATP World Tour. And now it can be used by you because you should check it out. That's why I'm talking to you. Try it for free for yourself. Check it out for yourself and see what you think. It's igloosoftware.com/twit or sign up for a live demo and you can see it in action for yourself. When you sign up through our link, you can get your own Igloo for up to 10 people absolutely free for as long as you want. That's igloosoftware.com/TWIT and we thank them for their support. All right, TNT's fan of the day is Brian Dice at Oswego Snowman on Twitter, who sent us this picture saying that he listens, quote, while mowing at the State University of New York, Oswego's Fallbrook Recreational Center. Oh, no. It's just a lawnmower. I don't know why Twitter thinks it's sensitive material. All it is a lawnmower. Twitter, I want to know what's up with your filter. if you want to check out what the picture is, it's a riding lawnmower, folks. You can. Just check out, I don't know, go on Twitter and search for
his
username. You'll be able to find it.
Lawnmower.
I know. It's a very risque lawnmower. It's green. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. Post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, but not if it's a lawnmower, and Facebook, and use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT, and we're going to find it.
So for the past few weeks, we've been dedicating a fair amount of time to talking about texting at public events like movies or comedy shows. Yesterday, Fusion published a story on a creative way to keep the audience from texting or from recording and sharing parts of the show. A startup called Yonder, like Yonder, but without an E, like it's still 2004 and we hate vowels.
Oh, they took out the E.
They did. Will provide venues with high-tech locking pouches where audience members can put their phones during the show, during the duration of the show. So they lock, and then you, if you absolutely need to use your phone, you go to an area where it unlocks, and go outside the phone-free area, and it unlocks, and you can use your phone.
Gives you access to your phone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's high-tech in the sense that the technology that locks it in there, but it's not like a Faraday cage. It's not actually like preventing any transmission to the phone inside of the
little
bag.
No, it's just
right?
locking it up. Yeah.
So what I wonder then is, I mean, this is all about preventing distraction. That's not going to prevent the phone from ringing, right?
I think it's not just about preventing distraction. I think it's mainly, well, they were talking about it with comedy shows.
Mm-hmm.
With comedy shows, you know, you're doing a comedy show, like everybody's drinking, like you've told a lot of jokes, and then you say something that is like for the crowd, but mm-hmm. then people have been videotaping it and then taking it out of context.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've seen a lot of that.
You know, and then comedians have been getting in a lot of trouble, like Hannibal Buress, like got rape threats, not rape threats, he got murder threats.
Mm-hmm.
But
because, well, no, I think what you're talking about is he's the one that made the joke about Bill Cosby.
Yes.
The whole Bill Cosby yes. rape allegations.
Yes. Yeah.
And so. Then he came under serious fire. I definitely yes. heard about that.
Yeah. So I think that's mainly what they're trying to keep. I mean, some distraction, but also just videotaping and, you know, and also videotaping it and, you know, putting it up online so people don't go to their shows.
Yeah. Because, I mean, Dave Chappelle obviously is, you know, a big part of this article. He's mm-hmm. one of the comedians who supports this. He's kind of ruthless with people at his shows, from what I understand, if he sees someone pull out a smartphone. And I don't know if it's necessarily just about like capturing the performance. It's like, oh really, you know, you're pulling out a phone, like I'm up here, that's very disrespectful, that sort of thing. Chappelle, Chris Rock, Louis C.K., Guns and Roses, throw that in there for good measure, all supporting this. Alicia Keys as well. It's like a chastity belt for your phone.
Oh, I like that. That's good.
I don't know. I was kind of a little, I wasn't sure whether I should say that out loud, but there we go. Maybe
you
it'll
did.
Be censored.
You said it.
I went there.
You, yeah.
all right, moving on. I'm out tomorrow, not because I'm fired because of that thing I just said, but I've got to go to the dentist. I'm not looking forward to it. Megan, you're going to be holding down the fort.
I am going to be holding down the fort. Sam Moscovich will be here, hopefully, from Ars Technica. And, I'm lining up a few other guests.
Boom.
And I think I can do it without you.
Well,
it's not as much fun, but...
We'll make up for it on Monday with more comments like the one.
Yes.
And more awkwardness to come. Team 2 records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 a.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can always be a part of the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv. Leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. And find us on Twitter. We're at TechNewsTodayTV.
You can subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNT. And if you want to tweet at me, I am at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to our technical director, Kara Cole, and Greg for running the prompter, and everyone who helped us produce this show every single day. And thanks to you for talking tech with us. Megan, we'll see you tomorrow.